This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Sad Eagle edition. It's Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016. On today's show, Designated Survivor is Guilty Pleasure TV. It's a new thriller from ABC in which Kiefer Sutherland is a sort of average Joe. He's a low-level cabinet secretary who becomes president after the entire line of succession ahead of him gets wiped out in a terrorist attack. And then the 13th is a riveting documentary about the rise of the prison industrial complex and its targeting of young black males, often for nothing more than profit. We're joined by Slate's own Aisha Harris. And finally, Vine. It was the micro video. It is, I guess, still the micro video service owned by Twitter. It's going away. And this has led to dozens of heartfelt elegies. Why did such a seemingly modest thing come to symbolize the internet at its best? We discuss with Slate's tech critic, Will Oremus. All right. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
How are you feeling?
I'm very sick.
No.
So I'm going to do my one segment where we don't have a guest, and then I'm going to let the guests sub in for me for our show today. Sorry to beg off.
And of course, I'm joined by Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Stephen.
I feel like, is Vine one of the first tech services that we reviewed when it dawned, and now we must bury it? I guess, I don't know if Chat Roulette still exists, but...
Chat Roulette. Oh my God, those were the days.
But don't you remember we made little vines? We vined for a bit.
Yeah, and I guess my account is among the ones that are going to be living on there forever because I never went and took it down again.
Yeah, I made one super creepy vine of a baby snow globe. That was my one contribution to Vine art. I don't think it will go down in the history books.
Julia, do we have some business to attend to before we dig in?
Yeah, just one bit of business today, which is that in our Slate Plus segment, we will talk about the immortal question, adults and Halloween, should they get dressed up for it? By the time you listen to this, Halloween may be fading away, but probably the Instagrams of people's costumes or lacks thereof may still be circulating on your feeds. So we will discuss whether we are dressers up or nay and why. You can listen to that after our show if you're a member of Slate Plus. If you're not, you can join at slate.com/culture plus. And for a limited time, we have a discount going. You can sign up for an annual membership at a discounted rate of only $35 for the first year. Go to slate.com/culture plus for that offer. All right, Steve, let's commence.
Designated Survivor is a post 9/11 high anxiety potboiler from ABC Television. It stars Kiefer Sutherland as a low level cabinet secretary. He's the secretary for HUD, poor HUD. He's about to get fired, but they throw him a little sop. He gets to be the designated survivor for the State of the Union address. And this being network TV, guess what happens? The State of the Union speech gets blown up. The line of succession is wiped out, and Kiefer Sutherland becomes president. The show is created by David Guggenheim, a veteran thriller hand, and it also stars Natasha McElhone as his Kiefer's wife and sudden first lady. Why don't we listen to a clip?
Mr. President, the UN is in emergency session. I have a 3-page phone list with every one of our enemies calling to deny responsibility for the attack.
All U.S. military bases are on full alert, and the USS Eisenhower is currently hard charging towards the 5th Fleet stationed in the Persian Gulf.
I understand alerting our bases, but... why are we hard-charging a U.S. aircraft carrier anywhere?
Mr. President, in the event of an attack...
An attack from who? You just said all our enemies are denying responsibility.
Because all warfare is based on deception, and there are still plenty we haven't heard from.
I just don't feel comfortable showing that kind of force yet.
Oh, with all due respect, sir, would you mind telling us when you do plan on being comfortable?
You'll be the first to know, General. Excuse me.
Julia, let me start with you. This is pretty pulpy, but kind of fun. Is it giving you pleasure, guilty or otherwise?
Oh my God, what a bad show, but I did gobble up 3 episodes. I think the most interesting thing to think about here is the evolution of the political thriller more than 10 years after 24. That was a show that assumed enemies everywhere and asked you to have faith in the hyper-competence of Jack Bauer, the one man who would fight all our foes, who would torture whoever needed to be tortured, who would extract information from whence it needed extraction, and like save the president's blonde daughter at just the right moment. Forgive me if I'm muddling the details, but that's my recollection of that show. And in this, we have a fantasy of like a totally decimated government that doesn't work at all, which some people might argue that our government is already in that state, even though it is intact, or that it may soon be it. In that state, depending on who wins the election next week. It's actually takes, you know, it's sort of a truism in Washington that Veep is the most accurate of the DC shows, that it's about like small, incompetent people making small, localized decisions and their foibles add up to our government. And this show strikes me as one that kind of takes that idea that everybody at the core of government is all too human and then puts that at the center of a thriller rather than a comedy.
Dana, what did you make of this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I agree with Julia. This show can't really be graded according to any standard of quality as a great show. But boy, does it speak to the anxieties of our moment, I think. I mean, just the idea of having Jack Bauer become the anti-Jack Bauer, as you say, this guy who's quavering, afraid to use force. Quavering is too dismissive of a word. I think that the viewer is really sort of put on the side of Kiefer Sutherland's character here, the suddenly president despite himself. And it really does make you feel the intense pressures of being just a lowly human suddenly elevated to this position of power. And in a way, that's the only emotional gambit the show has going for it that particularly works. But I think it works well enough that just being shoved by proxy into that position and thinking, oh my God, what would I do if it was me with these decisions being thrust onto me? That power alone carried the show a pretty long way.
Would you hard charge the Fifth Fleet?
I'm not comfortable with that yet, Julia.
Dana, let us know.
I think the show is ridiculously effective. I think it plays on sometimes cunningly and sometimes maybe cynically on two anxieties, one obvious and one somewhat less so. The obvious one is, of course, the frayed nerves of post 9/11 America. I don't like entertainment product that does that. I think it's just finally too manipulative, and it plays into really simplistic narratives about that event and its place in recent American history. And also, I just think if we are genuinely traumatized, as I think we are as a country, by that event, we ought to work through the trauma in different ways, maybe. But that's just me. Nonetheless, I do think it is very, very cunningly put together in the ways that it plays on the second, somewhat less obvious anxiety, which is, are we up to the task of self-government, right? I mean, that inherent modesty of the original idea, I mean, both hubris and modesty of the original idea of the American experiment, which is that ordinary people are perfectly capable, without kings and hereditary nobles and arbitrary authority from on high, or even really the approval of God, are capable of ruling themselves. And we're obviously at a huge turning point, crossroads in American history, in the question of whether we're really capable of it. The really intense moments that grabbed me were of this guy who's basically a housing, you know, nerd by a fluke accident becoming president, and he's wearing a Cornell hoodie, and he's just meant to look like a guy in a pair of New Balances. I mean, he's a dad. He's meant to be a real stand-in for the viewer, for the male viewer, and his wife is meant to be a stand-in for the, you know, kind of yuppie female viewer. And can they helm this now massive apparatus of the American superstate, which polices the globe, governs a continent, and essentially in a way a global economy? And what is it about the kind of ordinariness of self-governance as framers conceived it hundreds of years ago, when everyone was a farmer or a merchant in a very modest way? How do you apply that to this technologically super advanced
super state that we've created. I think that's a great setup, but I don't know that I'll follow this show for very much longer.
Yeah, I mean, for one thing,
I mean, it's fun to see Jack Bauer in like nerdy glasses getting told to take his glasses off before the teleprompter clicks on for his national address. It's fun to see him in like schlub role mode. But the show, as it gets a few episodes in, seems like it's setting itself up to be more Scandal in 24 than Veep or Dave. Isn't Dave the movie about a schlub becoming president?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's not really going to situate itself in that comedy mode for long. It becomes clear that there's all kinds of, you know, skullduggery and derring do around the edges, and that the show will live more in the world of, you know, cloak and dagger operatives and their secret plots. And I bet that Kiefer gets hep to it pretty soon and finds his own inner commander in chief, rather than continuing to just be like, oh man, this job, what the hell?
I think another thing that the show could do much, much better is exploring how bizarre it would be to have essentially all three branches of the government wiped out at once. I mean, at times the days that Kiefer Sutherland's president seems to be living are almost too normal for someone in those circumstances. I mean, in the moments that we do see Kiefer Sutherland outside near the site of the attack, there is essentially a smoking ruin of what was once the Capitol. So the entire Supreme Court has been taken out. All of Congress, except as far as we know at the beginning of the show, one member of Congress played by Virginia Madsen, has been wiped out. And so the idea that he would even be building a government from scratch seems like the most, I would like to go down those wonky roads and sort of see, like, what does the line of succession allow for? What are his powers as this newly empowered president? How is he going to get the three branches of government up and running again?
Right. And a couple of the power struggles in the early episodes do play with that in interesting ways. Like, there's one moment where one of his aides talks about how they'll never get one of their, you know, potential attorney generals past the hill. And then the guy she's talking to is like, there is no hill.
Right. There's just a pile of
there's like
rubble.
Nobody who has to approve this anymore. And then there's another interesting power struggle with a governor. The governor of one of the states is like, I don't recognize your authority. And it kind of thrusts you into the some of the founding battles of our country about the tensions between state and federal authority and who is really the boss of whom, and the things that we take for granted about how that works suddenly become undone in this world. But yeah, I think this show would only be worth watching if it was, to me, if it lived more in kind of alternate future wonk country and was really about our democratic institutions in some way and the way we think about power and governance. But I think it's basically just like they plan to use it more as just a great setup for a nighttime thriller soap.
And we haven't even mentioned the lowest rung of subplots, which is the family, having to care about the family of the president, which just feels like the most generic TV scenes ever. His adolescent son who's dealing drugs.
Oh, God. Yeah. And then they've got the like poor man's Kiernan Shipka. They've got this like little sweet little girl, Penny, I think is her name.
Whose whole job is to fling her arms around her father's neck and look vulnerable.
Yeah.
Peanut. Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me like both of you are pining for this to have been an HBO or Showtime or Netflix, you know, gourmet TV offering, which would have eliminated or downplayed or made interesting the family drama and upplayed the constitutional crisis for discerning viewers like us. But I mean, it raises the question. As I watched this, it made me realize I hadn't really lost myself in a network TV show in a really long time. And it's the whole idea of guilty pleasure TV seemed attached to me in some ways to channel surfing and sort of snagging on something barely better than the average thing on offer, show on offer, and then kind of losing yourself in it and then become guiltily pleasured by it. And becoming an addict and then watching it for 6 years, that seems to me sort of gone now, right? I mean, now that everything is so sophisticated and so good, who has time really for a TV show that's slightly better than the junk surrounding it?
Yeah, I mean, I'd push back on that a little bit. There are a few shows that sort of cross over between great network schlock and prestige TV / you know, compelling, snackable, joint digital second screen experience watching TV like Scandal, which I was up on until recently. But I don't think this show, and 24, right, was one of the originals at the dawn of prestige TV. It was a Fox thriller that the, you know, TV chattering classes enjoyed chattering about before the whole cornucopia of goods was on display that we have now. But just the potentially interesting things in this idea
which are the alternate wonkery of a destroyed Washington and theories of governance, and the emotional pathos of a man unexpectedly being thrust into this situation, don't strike me as the emotional or story terrain that network TV is best at.
Yeah, I essentially agree with that. The show is Designated Survivor. It stars Kiefer Sutherland. It's on ABC. If someone vociferously agrees or disagrees with us, come to facebook.com/culturefest and tell us about it. All right, Julia, reprieve. Go to bed. Hot tea.
Thank
you. A little whiskey.
Thank you for indulging my Kiefer chat with this absurdly gravelly voice.
Thanks for coming in and talking to us. All right, well, moving on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
13th is the new documentary by filmmaker Ava DuVernay. It lays out with icily passionate clarity the history of the prison industrial complex, the now vast system of mass incarceration that overwhelmingly targets young Black men, often for profit. But this extraordinary documentary does more than shock us with statistics, and they are shocking enough, but also with history, more precisely the historical continuity between the mass incarceration of Black men now and slavery and Jim Crow. Joining us to discuss 13th is Slate contributor and host of the podcast Represent, Aisha Harris. Aisha, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
All right, before we dig in, why don't we listen to a clip?
We should just set this up maybe a little bit first. What you're going to hear is the voice of two or three academics who were interviewed by DuVernay over the course of the film, and they're talking about the rise of Jim Crow in the post-war years in the South.
One of the things that people have to bear in mind is that when we think about slavery, it was an economic system, and the demise of slavery at the end of the Civil War left the Southern economy in tatters. And so this presented a big question. There are 4 million people who were formerly property, and they were formerly kind of the integral part of the economic production system in the South. And now those people are free. And so what do you do with these people? How do you rebuild your economy? The 13th Amendment loophole was immediately exploited.
After the Civil War, African Americans were arrested en masse. It was our nation's first prison boom.
You were basically a slave again. The 13th Amendment says that, hey, except for criminals, everybody else is free. Well, now if you're criminalized, that doesn't apply to you.
Let's start with the title. There is, and I didn't know this, I'm ashamed to say, going in, a kind of asterisk to the 13th Amendment.
Yes. The premise of the movie is that the 13th Amendment, which was supposed to free Black American slaves from bondage, that loophole, that asterisk that you mentioned, they call it the criminality clause. And essentially what it means is that slavery itself is outlawed, with the exception of punishment for a crime. And so this essentially allowed Black people to remain in many ways enslaved, both figuratively and literally, even after the idea of selling and buying slaves was no longer technically legal.
And that's in some ways the principal force of the documentary, right, is establishing this historical continuity using the theme of the criminalization of essentially being young Black and male, principally Black and male, but often young Black and male, and takes us through the various ways in which the asterisk has iterated itself out to new forms of slavery or segregation or rank exploitation. Talk a little bit about that history.
It's interesting the way the film sets this up, because it talks about the way in which before slavery was abolished, Black people were considered, you know, pretty docile and willing to follow orders and easy to tame. And Jelani Cobb, who is one of the talking heads, he's a contributing writer to The New Yorker and also a professor of history at UConn. He talks in depth about Birth of a Nation and how that sort of helped in the aftermath of, you know, in the midst of Jim Crow, how images like that of Black men being you know, rapists and ravishing and dangerous, how that sort of contributed to the criminality, the idea of the black male as a threat and a fear, and how that continues to this day to haunt America and specifically contributes to the way in which we look at black men, especially, but black women as well, but black men in a threatening and dangerous light.
Yeah, even though we just talked about Birth of a Nation, the D.W. Griffith Birth of a Nation, a few weeks ago on this show, something that Jelani Cobb said was something I had never realized, which is that cross-burning was essentially invented by D.W. Griffith, that was not even a feature of KKK raids until it was seen on the big screen. And, you know, when there was sort of this upsurgence and interest in the KKK, that became the symbol.
And I should, you know, to bring in contemporary events, Donald Trump repeatedly identifies himself as the quote-unquote law and order candidate. This is not new language at all, is it?
No, I mean, one of the things that the film does really well is it sort of indicts pretty much every president of the last 40 plus years in the way in which they've used, I mean, with the exception to some extent of Obama, but Obama's still included in a little bit in here too. But the ways in which they use the idea of law and order to appease the public and how they campaigned on these things. So you have Nixon in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, talking about pretty much the same sort of ideas that Trump is, and the way in which Reagan's policies, especially with the crack epidemic, helped to, you know, promote this idea of I'm like drugs are bad. And most of the people who are doing these drugs and who are selling these drugs are people in inner cities, code for black. And while they didn't always use the explicit language of it being black people, you knew what they were talking about. And so the film does a really good job of sort of digging into all of the ways in which these presidents have campaigned on this and how in the past the public really wanted this, including black Americans.
Well, Aisha, that raises the interesting question of the Southern strategy, the so-called method by which the Republican Party systematically attempted to switch the solid South from solidly Democratic to solidly Republican by essentially race baiting. A key figure in that was the political consultant Lee Atwater. He committed to all of eternity the confession of what the Southern strategy was actually made of. Why don't we listen to that clip?
There's really no understanding of our American political culture without race at the center of it.
And in 1981, just before Reagan assumed the presidency, his campaign strategist Lee Atwater was caught on tape explaining the Southern strategy.
In other words, you start out, and now y'all are quoting me. It's hard. You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you keep saying nigger. That hurts your backfire. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now. You're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things. And the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than white.
Well, Aisha, nothing about that clip has lost its power to utterly shock us. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think that it proves to me, not that I needed the proof, but I think it proves just how calculating all of this was in terms of how to make out the black urban population to be this scary mass, and how easy it was for them to play into the public's fears with regard to that.
Dana, one of the most powerful things about the documentary was, you know, out of this history of law and order candidates in the Republican Party is built a grotesque symbiosis between right-wing politicians, for-profit prison industry, and mediating them is an organization called ALEC. What do you know about ALEC?
Well, I didn't know anything about ALEC until watching this documentary. And I think for me, that was probably one of the big factual revelations. I mean, a lot of these stories are stories that if you have read anything about the history of civil rights, you're familiar, right? The story of Emmett Till comes up. And also a lot of recent stories right up to Sandra Bland and Eric Garner are talked about toward the end. But this ALEC was something I knew nothing about. It's an acronym for American Legislative Exchange Council. And it seems essentially to be a kind of private club that you can join as either a corporate representative of a corporation or of the government. That in itself is kind of alarming, where they sort of produce, it's like a legislation farm. They produce all kinds of legislation, most of it sort of helping to grow the prison industrial complex, and then just circulate it around to different state legislatures with essentially an empty place to put your state's name, and thereby, you know, propagating this kind of growth industry prison legislation. So, I mean, this is one of those glimpse behind the scenes, the how the sausage of law gets made moments that I think sets the documentary apart and really does make you see a horrifying part of the puzzle that hadn't been there before, and makes you understand why this counter that Ava DuVernay keeps going back to showing, almost like a cash register type counter that's counting up the prison population, why those numbers just keep on mounting so terrifyingly high from something like, I think, 700,000 incarcerated people in 1970 or whenever she starts, to something like 2.5 million today. So I'm wondering, we've talked a lot about the content of this show, but not at all about the form. What did you guys think of the way that this information is all presented and laid out by DuVernay? Did you find it effective, or what did you think fell down sometimes in the presentation?
This movie is a testament to the power of imagery, and she uses the cinematic voice in a way that I think is really captivating, and that no sort of article about the police industrial complex can do by itself, especially the montage towards the end where she has Trump's words. I don't remember what he was exactly what he was saying, but he was saying something along the lines of, like, we need to make America great again. We need to go back to the times when things were better. And you see this juxtapose overlaid with images of going back and forth between Trump supporters kicking people at rallies, specifically Black people, and punching them, and then cutting to imagery of Black people in the early 20th century getting beaten and kicked while trying to protest. So to me, that was that made this movie go above and beyond for me. Like her use of imagery and her use of the compare and contrast to how far we haven't come since then.
Yeah, I think she commands her archival clips extremely well, and I wish there'd been even a little bit more of that, because montage was one of the strong points in bringing the present and the past together in that way. In some other ways, though, this felt to me like a very standard agitprop-style documentary in terms of going from one talking head to the next and then some illustration of what that talking head said. I mean, her point here was not to do formal invention, but the moments that she did try to slightly displace that very familiar talking head format, to me, were just distracting. For example, did you guys notice that she never filmed any of her subjects head on? There was just a lot of tricky camera movement around talking heads, which doesn't really change the fact that it's a talking head.
Right. Yeah.
There's also this kind of what I think of as the Bob Dylan, you know, the famous Bob Dylan video where he's throwing down cards, right, flash cards with some of the words of the song.
The Subterranean.
Homesick Blues. Yeah. Exactly. So she's got a little bit of that going on, where sometimes as a quote is being read or someone speaking, sort of the key words of what they're saying are splashed up on the screen in big print. And to me personally, I feel condescended to by that kind of narrative manipulation of a documentary.
It seemed very influenced by Vox in some ways. Like, it presumed very little prior knowledge on the part of the viewer, which I think could be quite helpful. And then it made sure to tie up as much of the narrative in statistics, which are quite powerful. I mean, 1 in 3 Black men spend time in prison over the course of their lifetime. I mean, just preposterous numbers. And it drives home the case. And the case is, I think it's important to maybe separate out the raw power of the case being made against American society for inherently criminalizing essentially being Black and male, right? And the power of that is overwhelming. And when you get that story told in a fairly direct way, it gives it a fresh immediacy, especially as you say, that extraordinary sequence where Trump is making a speech and sort of boasting about how in the old days, you know, essentially if someone protested a rally, they had the shit kicked out of them, how wonderful that was. And to show actual archival footage from the 60s of, you know, protesters having the shit beat out of them, you know, just brings home what it is this candidacy represents. But the movie is not otherwise inherently powerful. Other than that sequence and a couple of others, it's very informationally based. But I thought that was fine. I think that bringing it all together and providing the synthetic legwork of by doing the synthetic legwork, showing this historical continuity that essentially, thanks to the criminality clause of the 13th Amendment, once you're convicted of a crime, you're effectively a slave of the state. I mean, you're certainly a victim of a quote unquote new Jim Crow. But I mean, you can make the extreme argument that you're effectively a slave of the state. That loophole in the Constitution and how it's been manipulated to keep continuity for young black males between their experiences now and their experiences 200 years ago, that to me is so intrinsically powerful. It didn't bother me that the mode of presentation was sometimes a little
utilitarian or something.
Utilitarian, great. Yeah, exactly that. Aisha, let me ask, in watching this, did you learn or feel anything new?
I definitely felt more dread. I think that I came away from it, and I think the point of the movie was to sort of inspire people to get enraged and get upset about it. And I did get up. I have to admit, I was crying by the end of it. I did not realize I was going to. I think part of it was that she does end with imagery, and this is something that was very deliberate. She ends on imagery of recent shootings and police shootings, and including, I think, we have Eric Garner, which was caught on video, all these shootings and killings that we've seen many times over. And then below it, or below each image, she says, you know, use with permission from their family. And she said in interviews that she was only using footage of deaths that she got direct permission from the families for, even though she didn't need to, which I think was really touching. I don't know if that's the word, but I think it was a very smart move on her part and a caring move, and shows sort of what her goal was with the film. So I was a bawling mess at the end of it. So I definitely felt I was affected by it, but these feelings weren't new. They were just kind of brought to the surface again for the umpteenth time.
All right. Well, the movie is called 13th. It's streaming on Netflix. You should absolutely watch it. Let us know what you think of it at facebook.com/culturefest. Aisha, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about the film.
Thanks again.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Twitter has announced that it is shuttering Vine, the service that allows you to upload 6-second videos. Little did I know until this was announced. Many people consider Vine to be an artistic medium and not just a novelty service. And in fact, something of the best expression of the best aspect of the internet. Who knew? And this has led to much mourning on the internet. To discuss Vine, we are joined by Will Oremus, who is, of course, Slate's tech columnist. Will, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Great to have you. In order to get at what the loss of this means, why don't we start by asking, what did the creators of Vine expect from this really kind of modest contribution to the platforming out of the internet? And what did it somewhat unexpectedly become?
So when Vine was created as a startup, the idea was that it would be these quick 6-second videos that you would just sort of casually share with other people, which is in fact what Snapchat became instead. Vine did not really become that. When Vine was bought by Twitter in 2012, it was bought for $30 million. Twitter saw it as the analog to a tweet, the video analog to a text tweet. And in fact, the constraint of those 6 seconds really from the beginning inspired creativity. Creative people took it as a challenge. What can I accomplish in 6 seconds with the ability to jump cut and to shoot a video just on my phone? And what happened was that Vine became this venue for these really creative, often hilarious videos. A lot of times people would play with the juxtaposition between the video and the sound, because it's sort of like a long GIF that has sound. And that's the big differentiator from a GIF. And so people would do these videos of like a dog seeming to dance or a robot seeming to dance, and then they would match it with music. So there was this one of this really creepy robot called Big Dog dancing back and forth, and somebody put in Toto's Africa as the soundtrack to it and matched up the timing of the dancing perfectly to the music.
Oh, I love the real dog coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could watch that a few hundred times.
Yeah. This was one of the many viral vines that over the years has made an impact way beyond the people who use the app, because you can see it on Twitter, you can see it on the web. So it really became a place for creative expression rather than this social sharing app that was originally envisioned. Vines were often weird. They were somehow strange or creepy or unexpected, and that was part of what people loved about them.
Given that Twitter is struggling itself as a business model right now, what was the point of selling Vine? Was it simply a money-saving measure, or is there some idea that somebody else owns this video area now and that there's nothing Twitter can do about it?
Yeah, well, it's in fact even worse than that. Twitter tried to sell Vine and could not find a buyer. So it's just shutting it down. It's shutting down the mobile app. Fortunately, the videos will live on the web, Twitter says. I'm sure there will be people who are rushing to archive them somehow for posterity. But Vine had really nosedived in popularity in the last couple of years. It probably peaked in around the summer of 2014. And since then, a lot of the people who had gotten sort of internet famous by making Vine videos had jumped ship. They had moved to competing services that simply were bigger and offered a bigger audience. So you had Instagram started offering 10-second videos. Sorry, Instagram had 15-second videos. Snapchat has 10-second videos and started allowing people to broadcast them publicly. Those two in particular really ate into Vine's market share. And then there are Facebook video people and YouTube video people, and the stars of Vine, which were there's a real thing. They mostly had abandoned it over the past year or so for these other services where they could actually make more money and find a bigger audience. So as to why that happened, I think it is related to Twitter's problems as a business. Twitter just has had this revolving door at the top. It has not been able to consistently monetize its products, including its own core product. And it, with Vine in particular, it brought it in and it made it sort of a big hit, but then it was just sort of, by all accounts, it was just sort of left to languish. There was a small team in New York City all the way across the country from Twitter headquarters in San Francisco that was working on Vine. It didn't seem to be one of Twitter's core priorities. Twitter has been scrambling so hard to try to grow its user base and to meet all these expectations of its investors. And it really seems like Vine just never topped the priority list for Twitter, and it got surpassed by these other services.
Right. It's almost as if the limitations that made it so appealing to its core group of users were what shut everybody else out, right? It became this little niche thing that a few people loved very strongly, but that had no kind of horizontal place to go.
Yeah, and in that way it really is analogous to Twitter, because Twitter itself is a service where the people who use it, a lot of them absolutely love it. I mean, they live on Twitter all day, and journalists are among them. Celebrities are among them, comedians, some other people, but
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is among them, and Twitter has just really struggled to be able to take that sort of that loyalty and that love that its core users have, and translate that into the kind of financial results that a much bigger platform like Facebook has been able to show consistently year after year. And you know, I think part of the issue may be the publicness. You know, if you want to broadcast your thoughts, Twitter's the place to do it. If you want to make a video that you think is really cool and that you want everybody to see, Vine at its peak was a good place to do that. But if you just want to casually share something with your friends, which is a use case that I think for most people is much more common than wanting to broadcast something to the world, then Twitter is a scary place to do that, because strangers could come in and rip you to shreds, or your tweet could end up on some website making fun of you, or just nobody could see it at all because your friends aren't on there. And I think the same was true of Vine. It felt like it was such a challenge that creative people were excited by it. But the average person who just wants to share where they are or what they're doing at the moment, Snapchat with the videos that disappear and that don't live on the internet for everybody to see forever was a much more comfortable place to do that. And so I think this whole idea of publicness has been one of the biggest problems for Twitter, and I think it was to some extent for Vine as well.
Will it is this it would it be overstretching the argument to say that this is a kind of inverse proportionality between what's spontaneous, organic, interesting, and intrinsically wonderful about the internet and the ability to monetize it?
It's a good question. I mean, it does often seem like the most beloved services are not the ones that achieve that huge ubiquitous scale like Facebook. I mean, who says, God, I love Facebook? You never, right? You never hear, Facebook is my favorite app. No.
With a big cup of Starbucks and Facebook is all I need.
Right. I think, you know, it's probably, maybe it's overstretching it a bit, Stephen, but I don't think it's crazy to say that there is some inverse relationship there between how beloved something is and the kind of massive scale and revenue that it can achieve. One other thing that I think is really worth pointing out about Vine is that it had become in particular a home for creative people of color, and in particular for Black people had really adopted Vine and made Vine their own. And you heard from Twitter when it was announced that Vine would be folded, you heard just a lot of sadness and grief and a feeling of loss, especially from Black Vine users who felt like, you know, this was really a community that they had built. It felt like a home for them online. And you know, not just in terms of the funny videos and the creative stuff that comedians and the Vine stars had done, but also when you look back to Ferguson and the protests there, we did not yet have Periscope, we didn't have Facebook Live, and so Vine was really the central way that people shared videos from Ferguson. So its cultural impact, as with Twitter, its cultural impact really outstripped its business impact.
Mm-hmm. This raises the question of Twitter then. I mean, Twitter is, its cultural penetration, as it were, is far deeper and broader than Vine could have ever hoped to have achieved. It's absolutely integrated into many journalists' way of looking at the world and promoting their work and existence within the world. And yet, Twitter can't make enough money to please Wall Street. So obviously, this raises the perennial question of Twitter.
Yeah, and it's a good time to talk about Twitter, because Twitter itself explored the idea of a sale. And there were several companies that were clearly interested. You had Microsoft, you had Alphabet, which owns Google, you had Salesforce, which was sort of an unexpected name. And then you had Disney, which was a really intriguing name. Disney has invested heavily in Vice. It's interested in new media. It's a media company, which seemed to align with what a lot of people think Twitter is or should be. So you had at least four companies that were interested, and eventually they all backed out of buying Twitter. And at least two of the companies, Salesforce and Disney, sources told tech reporters that the reason they backed out was at least partly because of the trolls. And by the trolls, we mean it's sort of a broad group, but it's the people on Twitter who sort of spew racist or sexist stuff. It's the spam accounts. It's the porn bots. It's just all the crap that clutters up Twitter, kind of the way that MySpace used to be cluttered up right around the time that Facebook surpassed it. And Disney understandably did not want to be taking over a service that has become really the service of choice for anti-Semites and for you know, anyone who wants to harass and abuse people online. And, you know, maybe it will just keep taking hits on Wall Street until finally its valuation is reasonable, until finally its valuation is in line with a niche service that is used by tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people, but will probably never be used by billions of people.
Let's end by saying something respectfully eulogistic about Vine. What do you think in the wake of its demise?
I think the coolest thing about Vine to me is that these Vine stars just came out of the woodwork. I mean, these were almost uniformly people that nobody knew or had heard of. They were people shooting videos in their bedrooms, in their basements, at their desks, you know, secretly when their boss wasn't looking. And they took the constraints of this form, the 6 seconds, and the fact that you have to shoot it on your phone and you can make a couple of jump cuts. And they made beautiful, hilarious, ridiculous works of art. And that's just inspiring. And they gained hundreds of thousands of followers, tens of millions of people looped their vines. And those will live on, fortunately. Our engagement editor, Chelsea Hassler, compiled some of the best vines, and I contributed a few to those. So I think, you know, it's a happy story that Vine existed, even though it's a sad story that it's gone.
Let's throw this one out to the listeners. We'd love to know what your experience with Vine was. Explain it to us, what you loved about it, and post what you did with it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Will, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's always a total delight.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse
Okay, well, for a couple of reasons, I'm going to endorse a short, funny video this week, in part because we talked about Vine. This is not a Vine video I'm going to endorse. It's a little bit longer, just slightly over a minute. But since we were talking about the power of short, homemade videos to change the world, and also just because this is such a heavy time, the election is only a week away, every day is fraught with high stakes horror about the future and what's happening to our country. So I'm just going to endorse something goofy and delightful that makes you proud to be an American. It's a 1 minute and 11 second video that was posted to Twitter a few weeks ago by a user named Young J Music. And the only description he gives is that I'll read the tweet to you. My lil cousin decided to try on his Halloween costume today and ... I'ma just leave this here. And so then he shows this video of this. All I'll tell you is that a young boy dressed as a marshmallow then hoverboards into view. And what unfolds after that, you'll just have to look at it to discover. We'll post the video to our show page.
Will, what do you got?
I'm going to endorse Major League Baseball's World Series, which has been going on for the past week. We're recording this before Game 6, which happens on Tuesday night. So we don't know if it will be over by the time people listen to this. If Cleveland wins tonight, it will be over. Either way, we have the Chicago Cubs, who have not won the World Series since 1908, the Cleveland Indians, who have not won since 1948. So somebody is going to be breaking a ridiculously long drought. The baseball has been fantastic. Both managers are of the new school, where they're willing to try things differently. Each team has one of the best relief pitchers ever to play the game. Cleveland has Andrew Miller. Chicago has Aroldis Chapman, who throws the ball over 100 miles per hour every time he throws a fastball. And they use them in unorthodox ways. They'll bring them in sort of in the middle of the game rather than at the very end of the game. They're letting the best players push themselves to their absolute limits of endurance. It has been wonderful baseball. There have been great moments. Bill Murray sang Take Me Out to the Ball Game with a Daffy Duck voice. It's great baseball. It's great TV. And I feel fortunate that we have gotten to see these two teams playing again and again.
Yeah, here. I'm completely with you on this one, Will. It's been a pretty drama-filled. I mean, it's so inherently drama-filled with these two teams, but it's lived up to it. I really hope Chicago pushes it to Game 7. And what did you make of Eddie Vedder?
I actually did not hear Eddie Vedder sing. I was watching the game while doing the dishes. I couldn't hear the sound. I gather that people loved it. He did dedicate the seventh inning stretch to the Cubs catcher David Ross, who's just this kind of the perfect World Series hero, this 39-year-old catcher, more than a decade past his prime, but he's scrappy. He catches one of the most difficult pitchers to catch, the Cubs' John Lester. He had made some crazy and amazing plays early in the game, and before Eddie Vedder sang Take Me Out to the Ball Game, he praised Ross as just a genuine, down-to-earth, nice guy. I thought that was that's a pretty cool way to dedicate the seventh inning stretch if you're a rock star.
I didn't watch it. I didn't see that. I just kept seeing things on my Twitter feed of heterosexual men saying that they want their marital exemption to switch to Eddie Vedder. I mean, he seemed to be making a lot of people swoon.
I love the fact that as good as the baseball games have been, the seventh inning stretch has been just as entertaining.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I'm going to endorse an essay that originally appeared in the wonderful magazine, internet magazine, Aeon, out of Australia. It's gone global. It's a wonderful find, and its archives are well worth browsing through. But they actually co-published something with the Atlantic Monthly by a Scottish academic named David Farrier. It is a beautifully written, very short essay about the concept of deep time. And I guess essentially as the science of modern geology developed, people started to get a more precise sense of exactly how many eons the Earth had been in existence prior to humanity. And deep time is basically the concept of pre-Anthropocene time and just how vastly much of it there was, and sort of philosophically how vastly much of it there needed to be in order to produce humanity and human consciousness, and the sublimity of trying to take into the limited window of human consciousness something as completely immense and yet constitutive of us as deep time. It's wonderful how quickly he gets that on the page. But then he starts talking about that's the deep past, and he makes this wonderful and quite poetically delivered point about the deep future and what precisely we might be living to it. I mean, just to give one example that he gives, we slaughter tens of millions of chickens every year across the globe. And so were some future civilization to try to pick through the earth to try to figure out what was here first, they would conclude that chickens had covered the entire face of the earth on the sheer number of fossils and bones left behind. But let me just give you one sentence to give you a sense of how beautiful the writing is. The irony of the Anthropocene is that we are conjuring ourselves as ghosts that will haunt the very deep future. And it's kind of a shivery and sublime set of thoughts delivered quite well and succinctly by David Farrier. And the second thing I'd like to endorse is democracy. And, you know, many people died for the right to vote, for our right, for my right to vote. And I think this is the year maybe to exercise it at all costs and in favor of the candidate that you deem most likely to defend the bedrock principles of this country, including the right to vote. I think it's obvious who that is. I hope it's obvious to every listener of this show who that is. And it's that rare moment when in the palms of all of our individual hands lies this heritage, which is of radical self-governance, which is the gift that this country gave the world. Don't trash it. Honor it and go vote. All right. Thank you very much. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you guys so much. It was fun as always.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our interns are Lizzie Fison and Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers. He is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Hail to the chief. The Culture Gabfest is part of that network. You can check out an entire roster of really excellent and like-minded shows at itunes.com/panoply. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner, Will Arimus, Aisha Harris, Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we'll see you next week. The world doesn't end. We'll see you next week.